I'm here for 3 weeks on the faculty, and I'm in a little bit of a spot today because of the way we move around in our attendance as to when we come as well as when we leave. Last week I gave 3 lectures that lead up to this one. So I'm going to have to deal a little bit with some of that background. We're dealing with a subject called the Eastern Orthodox Connection. It has relationship with the French Connection and the Colombian Connection, and using that terminology. And as one person who for maybe 40 years, 42 or 3 years, has been interested in the Orthodox tradition, I'm giving you my reactions and what I've learned, and maybe something you can learn from a group of people that you don't know much about or haven't spent a lot of time studying. You'll learn a lot of new terms, and I'm going to read something in a moment about that. But the basic reason I'm here giving these is that in the first 2 weeks in August, I was giving the lectures at an ecumenical seminar in Cyprus. And it was a very fine group of people. Most of them were clergy, but there were not all clergy. And a couple of bishops were involved, and I always like to be able to tell bishops a few things, not always theological things, but that's part of my life. Yesterday, some of you were here when we talked about the personhood or humanity, or the old-fashioned word was man in the Old Testament, but that didn't exclude woman in the Old Testament. And I should have read even yesterday one of the things I read last week as an introduction. I'd like to read 3 little statements about when you hear something new, whether you're a Lutheran or a Catholic or an atheist or whatever, it's worthwhile thinking about a few things. Now, first, there was a book written by David Lockhart in 1977, The Liberation of the Bible. Now, that may sound heretical to you already, since we're going to talk about what is heresy in the Orthodox tradition. This is one simple sentence. The Bible is an ideological captivity. Our goal is to liberate the Bible from our personal ideologies. And, you know, many of us have been brainwashed about what soul means, and we read the Bible with our brainwashed brains. Some of you from the West Coast, many of the others of you, know Robert McAfee Brown. He's been very much of a leader in the ecumenical movement and in theology in general. And in 1978, he wrote a book called Theology in a New Key. And I like this. And then I'm going to go secular in a minute. We read what we can bear to read. We hear what is tolerable to hear. We evade or spiritualize those parts that leave us uncomfortable, if not outraged. If you think about that a moment, that says a lot about our reactions to hymnals and Bible translations, our reactions to getting rid of the word soul out of our vocabulary, or our reactions to the fact that maybe foot washing is a sacrament that we've ignored, which was one of the lectures last week. It gives us the whole opportunity to recognize that when John doesn't have anything about Holy Communion in it, and then we have to spiritualize chapter 6 or chapter 13 or chapter 20, maybe this is the truth. Maybe we've missed something. Now, it just happens that I read a photographic magazine, Modern Photography, while I've been up here. And this fits very well with what I'm getting into. And then I'll review a little bit of last week's lectures, and then we'll get started. There will be no end of the making of pictures. Some of you went with Dan on a camera hike Sunday. Some with hands revealed and some without hands. But we should make the distinction, while it is still clear, between photographs that mirror the subject and images that reveal the photographer. One is intrinsically photographic, the other is not. Stieglitz, who has a big reputation, you know, for his poetry and pictures and for his beautiful exhibitions of photographs, Stieglitz arranged Georgie O'Keeffe, a writer, an unadorned fact of nature. She's not that beautiful, as he's trying to say. An unadorned part of nature. Fact of nature, sorry. We see her as composition, a Stieglitz arrangement. Only the photographer, not the camera, could make something synthetic out of such a subject. In other words, instead of the real Georgie O'Keeffe, you got Stieglitz's idea, synthetically set. Then I like this one. This is very good, and I hope it doesn't bother your Norwegian piety if you come from the very Haugian group. Another Stieglitz photograph, captioned Spiritual America, shows the rear quarter of a horse with a harness. Is this a photograph of the horse or of the photographer? So you see, that's where we are. Now, my first lecture was on the divine liturgy as worship as the family of God. And in the Orthodox tradition, there are no cry rooms, there are no nurseries. Children are accepted, children belong. Once they've been baptized, they are part of the congregation. They crawl around on the floor, they cry. People come in and out. If they don't want to stay for all 4 hours, they just enjoy the part they need. But they say, many of their theologians, that the liturgy begins when you leave home, not when the priest or the deacon begins the readings. And it doesn't end after you go out in peace. It continues not only till you get home, but for the 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, and 13th, and 14th day of the week. The other part about worship is that they feel it's very important that people have it in their own language. Long before Luther, and you know, we've always given Luther a lot of credit for saying if you don't have it in your own language, it won't mean anything. Because he was in the Western world where the Catholics, the Roman Catholics, had concretized what was originally supposed to be for the common people. That's what the Vulgate means. When Jerome translated Hebrew and Greek into Latin, he did it into the popular language of what people were talking in the Roman Empire at that time. But it got solidified, concretized, spiritualized, and canonized. So that up until very recently, that was the version. But ever since the 4th century, the Greeks and others in the East sent missionaries to Yugoslavia, sent them to what we now call as Serbia, sent them to Bohemia, sent them to Russia and Poland. And the first thing they ever did was to translate the liturgy first into the language of the people, and secondly, the Bible. And we Westerners never get told that in our church history stories. We've been neglectful of that. So we not only have the unity of the family in the worship, but we have the unity of ethnic groups using the same liturgy but in their own language. So that although the Serbians and the Russians and the Poles and the Greeks and the Copts and the Ethiopians may all have a different language, they feel a unity as the family of God. They're together with that. In the West, the Mass has become such a thing for the Roman Catholics that it's the obligation of a priest to say it daily. Now sometimes they run out of altars in certain churches, and so they concelebrate. But in the East, it's absolutely impossible for a priest or a bishop to celebrate the divine liturgy unless some of the family are present. Not only is he not obligated to say Mass or the divine liturgy every day, he's prohibited from, unless some of you are around. And I think that's an important part of the differentiation. And when we get to heresy a little bit later, if I get to it, you'll recognize how that could lead into other kinds of ways of looking at things. I use the illustration about this whole family and the need to gather together in the divine liturgy to celebrate the mystery of Christ's presence and our presence with Christ by referring to what Lutherans rationalized many times about confession and instruction before Holy Communion. When I was trained, even by my father and by other people in seminary, we were said, you should examine yourself and eat and drink worthily, and then unworthily was not discerning the Lord's body. And rationally, Lutherans and Western Roman Catholics and most Protestants, not discerning the Lord's body had something to do with the elements. You know, was he really present, or how was he really present, or what kind of philosophy or theology where we're going to spin out of thin air about that. But if you know anything about Paul, and most Lutherans do, because, you know, Luther was prejudiced toward Paul, the body of Christ everywhere else in the epistles of Paul means the church. The church, the family of God, is the body of Christ. And so when some Episcopalians and some Lutherans, who shall be nameless, insist on closed communion, they somehow forget the body of Christ that's there, surrounding it. And that body of Christ in the Orthodox, and with this I close the first lecture, you're getting a bag full today, and that is that we Lutherans and most Westerners divide the visible and the invisible church. We divide the triumphant and the militant church. We make all kinds of divisions. In the Eastern Orthodox Church, the Divine Liturgy is a celebration of all the saints, the dead as well as the living. And that's why you see all the saints, or maybe in the Nicosia Cathedral that I attended a few weeks ago in Cyprus, the whole ceiling and wall is filled with church history, including some of the not-so-saintly people who killed some of the saints. So that you get the whole picture of the history of the Eastern Church in that cathedral, for people who could read or for people who couldn't read. But basically because they believe that this is the celebration, not on the first day of the week, as some Lutherans and Catholics say, not on the seventh day, as the Adventists and some Adventist Baptists and Jews say, but they say this is the eighth day. We worship on the eighth day. The theology of the eighth day is a very important statement. We're worshiping with all the heavenly hosts. We are in the presence of Christ. The eschaton, the end of all things, is at hand. And the iconostasis, that screen that has three doors in it that people go in and out, and some people wonder what all the mystery is about. It's not that bad after you learn what they're doing and why. That's because that's the portal to heaven. And all the saints aren't up there. The saints are right here in front of you, around you, and you have joined. So it really is the divine liturgy. And that leads us in, if all of the family are to worship, that leads me into my second lecture, infant communion. If you're LCA, you know that there's been a pretty big fight the last 2 years about whether you should commune babies. You know, we moved it from adolescence to the fifth grade in many of the ALC and LCA churches. Many Missouri churches didn't like that, and they didn't go along, although a few did. But when I gave the lectures about that some years ago, I always had in the back of my mind, how come we stop at the fifth grade? We had all kinds of rational, pedagogical, psychological arguments about when do people able to understand theological concepts. When can they deal with that kind of thing? And that was the rationale. I think we could have done better with the Catholics going to the first or second grade when the distinction between reality and fiction, between myth and reality, if you want to use that word myth in the popular sense of the word. But if this is the family of Christ, and if even as the Lutheran new hymnal says, we are members of the church by baptism, and if it says communion is the right of the baptized, then maybe the Eastern Orthodox could teach us a thing or two, in spite of what Dr. Crumley or the Executive Council of the ALC might say. Maybe they could say something to us. As soon as you're baptized, as soon as you're anointed, which happens within the first 3 years at the latest of birth, sometimes very early, it depends on when Pentecost and Easter come. You know, if you're born in July, you're going to be at least a year old probably by the time you get baptized, because the baptisms are done by the family, not by grandpapa's family, but by the family of the total church. So as soon as you're baptized and sealed, you have communion. Now in the Western Church, that tradition continued up until the 12th century, believe it or not. But by the 12th century, Roman Catholics began to get worried about handling the holy substance. The priest got to be a magician who turned things. And you got body and blood to handle. And little babies, gosh, if you ever fed them pablum, you know they gets all over the floor. So you can't trust a little baby to drink wine or to do that. The Eastern Orthodox have a simple answer for that. Do what we do over here. You can do intinction. Mama can stick it in, and they can have a little bit of sop, if you want to use a New Testament word, bread dipped in wine. But if they don't like that, they're even better than that. I think this is fun. Mama puts, or the priest, either one, can put the finger in the wine chalice, and there's not a baby alive who doesn't know how to suck on my finger. Whether I'm priest or not priest. So, you know, it was our rationalization, and that's going to be getting us close to where we are in a moment. Our rationalization about Holy Communion and its elements, and what had happened to it by the power of the priest, that moved us away from infant communion. We did a little trick last week. We took all the reasons for and against infant baptism. And every argument you've ever heard in Lutheran, Baptists, or other circles against baptism or for baptism hold against and for communion of infants. Absolutely the same arguments are used. You have to decide, is it more important to let the people know from the very word go that you're part of the family of God, or do you wait till they have some kind of rational instruction, and then you've twisted the whole concept of the gospel, which is an experience of faith, an ontological significance of who I am as a child of God, rather than what I think. See, in the West, we usually think of faith, not Lutherans, and Lutherans are a little better than most Western, but many people, when they think of faith, especially Roman Catholics and some Reformed, think of faith as a bunch of confessions. Apostles' Creed, Nicene Creed, the Augsburg Confession, the Book of Concord, the Heidelberg Catechism, the Westminster Confession, and that's the faith of the fathers. But when that song was written, Faith of Our Fathers, it was experience. So we have tended to think of understanding, intellect, and rationality. The East tends to think of belonging, of experiencing, of having a mystery. Do you know they're so dumb they don't even define how many sacraments they are? You know, we say there are two, or maybe last night I said Luther occasionally got up to four. Catholics are pretty firm that there's seven. But even the Catholics didn't know there were seven until about the Middle Ages. They didn't start enumerating. And nowhere in Eastern Orthodox theology or in Eastern non-Orthodox theology, Eastern churches, does anybody enumerate how many sacraments there are. They run anywhere from 2 to 6 to 7 to 10 to 13. And they never use the word sacrament except when they're talking to us Westerners. They like the word mysteries. Now, if it's a mystery, then we can't tell exactly how it all happens. Then we can't tell what belongs or not. Does a rosary become a mystery? Does a novena become a mystery? Does anointing the sick become a mystery? You know, we, along with the Catholics, we've got three signs that say this is a sacrament. Earthly means or material element of some kind, spiritual or heavenly blessing, commanded by Christ. That's usually what we do. Catholics broaden the word commanded by Christ into commanded by God. And God can do it through the Pope. He can do it through the Old Testament. That's how marriage and ordination get in, because God did it. But Lutherans get a little narrow-minded, and I mean that literally, narrow-minded. And we say, Christ didn't command marriage, and he didn't. Christ didn't command confirmation, and he didn't. We get all this rational reason for not having it. The Greeks say, forget it. It's all a mystery anyhow. And the important thing is, God loves you and has given you, as Ed said in Titus this morning, grace. The grace of God which sends the Holy Spirit and which sent Christ is important. So when I had my third lecture, I talked about foot washing as the forgotten sacrament. Is foot washing in John the sacrament or isn't it? We neglect it, except occasionally now in the green book, they allow you to have it on Holy Thursday. We had it out here at Holden one year when I was here. I think they had it this summer, I heard. Somebody had a foot washing ceremony here at Holden. Was that just a ceremony? Was it just a reenactment? Was it just a drama? Was it just a play game? Or was it a mystery? Maybe it might even be a sacrament. Now, about 10 years ago, I first got exposed to, when I was working in adult education for the ALC down at Texas Lutheran College, I came out to California, and all of us who were in adult education for the ALC and a couple LCA people were thrown in for good measure. We heard a Missouri Synod professor, some of you know, by the name of Warren Schmidt, very great guy. He's got a book out and a film strip has been put out on it called Is It Always Right to Be Right? And it's good because he talks about it. But he introduced me to something that's been a theory for the last 10 years, and neurosurgeons fight it. I have one in my congregation that I just retired from who fought it very strongly. Some accept it, but many other people. Now remember, it's a theory, but I'm going to bring the blackboard up and we're going to go through it just quickly. It's a theory about the left and the right hemispheres of the brain. Not the lobes. We're not talking about lobes. Although when I get into my feeling on old, I talk about social lobotomy, which is what we do to the aged many times by isolating them, putting them into nursing homes, or ignoring them and their needs. Let me bring this over for a minute. It won't take a moment. And I put up some things that may or may not be to you as different as I see them different. Move it back just a little bit. Will it help? Okay, thank you. Let me get on the side here. I think they can pick me up if they need to. You know that when people have strokes, if the stroke is on the left side, it bothers the brain, it bothers the right most of the time, and vice versa. If the hemorrhage is over here, it bothers the left. Now, except for speech and memory, which apparently can be transferred, most of these things are determined by the hemisphere or the other hemisphere. And I've done a little thing here. Remember, this is a theory. Remember, I pushed it to its limit deliberately to let you know. I always do that. Vern Rieke and I use that teaching technique sometimes to overemphasize and exaggerate. But to use educational terms, the left is the cognitive, the right is the affective. Those are terms that a lot of people use in educational psychology jargon. But if you want to use our terms, rational with a neat, closed system where you got A and B equals C, or A times B equals AB, or whatever. But this is emotional, it's inconsistent, it's loose, it's open. This has systematic theology. It has dogmas. Talks about dogmatics. This one has mystery. It has a liturgy. And the Eastern Orthodox, by the way, just to add a little bit from lecture one, that liturgy is the first part that forms the people's faith. Because you're experiencing the presence of all the saints and God. And so liturgy, not doctrine. If you want to know about the Eastern Orthodox, Floreski said, who died in August, Floreski said, go to the liturgy. Don't read a book. But what do? When we have an inquirer's class in the Lutheran Church, we hand them a book. We give them some lectures. We tell them, this is what we think. If we're honest enough, we say, this is what we think. Mostly, we say, this is what we know. And that's a difference. They use syllogisms and logic if you're rational. Over here, you got visions. Glory. Here you have the Sermon on the Mount in some ways. Here you emphasize the Transfiguration. Just another brief thing. Our major festivals are Christmas, which Ed mentioned this morning, Good Friday, Easter, and Pentecost. Their major festivals are Epiphany, Transfiguration, Easter, Ascension, and Pentecost. You note the difference? How many of you have ever gone to a glorious Transfiguration Day service? One has? Okay. Anybody else?
I've been to Good Friday one.
Yeah, well, see, they eliminate Good Friday.
No.
Almost. Well.
Not around there.
All right. let me say that it's not as important as Easter. I went through the important services, and I'll let you say what you do, because it's very clear they worship on Good Friday. They have gorgeous services. I've been to 7 or 8 of them in the Near East and in Toledo. But it's not emphasized as much as Easter and Transfiguration is. They have, I'm not saying they deny Good Friday.
They start at their Easter service at midnight.
Sure, that's when they baptize everybody.
On Saturday.
That's right.
And start into it. They make it long.
Sure.
But Good Friday service was 3 hours long. And
well, every Sunday morning is 4 hours. So, you know. So if we're not to say it's a big service because of length, well then, Sunday wins over Good Friday. You know, what I'm saying is, what's the emphasis? And Thursday I'm going to emphasize Easter's more important than Good Friday to them. That's the other side. You may enjoy the service. I do too. I get in trouble with Ricky on this next one, but in morals, for example, most white-collar crime is from this side. Computer fraud, other kinds of fraud, extortion, embezzlement. It's rationally thought out. Except if you've got some plans, most murders are spontaneous, home. Much adultery and rape is that way. It's relatively spontaneous. Some people have a seduction plan. Some people go out to track and rape. And most looting after hurricanes and tornadoes. Nobody planned that out, said the next hurricane, this is where we go first. You suddenly get caught up. And so there's that difference. We're pushing it a little bit. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Paul tend to be that way. John and the book of Revelation are on the other side, you know, with that kind of a thing. We like to talk in the West about juridical salvation. Our sins have been taken away. We've been proclaimed just like some divine lawgiver up there or some judge who does it over there. Alain tried to get the Lutherans to resurrect the Eastern Orthodox Christmas Victor theme. Christ has won a battle, and we are the participants of it along with all the saints who are around us. If you take it in Lutheran history, Melanchthon is much more a systematic theologian than Luther is. Luther is crazy, inconsistent. His bowels influence his theology and the way he talks. His beer got in the way occasionally, and all kinds of things were there as far as this goes. We like to think Western man is homo sapiens, rational. I like the phrase that the Eastern Orthodox use, and one Roman Catholic added this one, homo adorans. It's the worshiping human being that's significant, or the playing human being, ludens. The cough drop people, you know?
Yeah.
That's it. One more. General, put a few names in, and then we'll get down to the final thing. Bart versus Merton. You know, Ed Schramm mentioned, John Schramm mentioned that yesterday. Boltzmann versus Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. You know, they're a different idea of who the Christ is, or what the Bible is trying to say to me. Or, if you want to go into a very deep theology, take Wittgenstein versus Cervantes and Don Quixote. Yeah. Or Blake. I got Blake over here somewhere.
Yeah.
He would fit in there, you know. Then we got against Burke. Mm. Or even Thomas Paine is sort of mixed up. Thomas Paine is very rational at times, but he's also irrational. Now, this is basic to try to see and not argue the points. As I say, I've exaggerated it, and that's why this lady's saying, well, I put down Good Friday, and Good Friday is a service in the Eastern Orthodox churches. All of them have Good Friday services, but the emphasis is not Good Friday. The emphasis is Easter, and Easter lasts from Saturday night until Sunday noon. And it's the baptismal night, it's the new appearance of converts, if there are any, and that sort of thing. And that's the big service, if you want to call it big service. But Transfiguration and Ascension, we don't do much about. Epiphany we don't do much about, unless Christmas is on Sunday, and that makes Epiphany on Sunday. Then we do something about it. Let me illustrate by getting to what we're talking about now. Some of you know a very fine Lutheran scholar who's in the East now, but he grew up in and taught in Chicago for a while, Yaroslav Pelikan. Pelikan is a good friend of mine. He's preached for me several times, and I work with him in other ways. He's written and is still writing and still publishing a whole volume of books on Eastern theology. Eastern Christianity and its history. And look at this. I just want to read it because I think it fits what we're talking about. The original title that he and the editors decided for this series was called The Mind of Eastern Orthodox Christendom. That was the title. As it came out now, and they've got two volumes out, and the third is due any time, it's called The Spirit of Eastern Christianity. You know, he doesn't use the word Orthodox because they don't like dogma.
No.
Doxy means, has a relationship to dogma. If it meant only praise, as we Lutherans do in doxology, that would be nice. But doxa, glory, and doxa, dogma, are the same words. And so he got rid of orthodox, and he got rid of mind. And here's his rationale for it. Let me just read you that. I think it makes some sense. The substitution of spirit for mind is a very subtle question because they do not want to be considered rational. And then I'll quote a little bit more from this. The theology of speculative knowledge and religious experience occupied a large place. Note those words, subjective knowledge. We are always going for objective truth. Subjective knowledge and religious experience. Now, some of you who go to the liturgy may say that's rote, it's formal, but for those who are with it, for if you go often enough, you'll be as overwhelmed by the services as you and I have been, by the music, by the significance, by the symbolism, by the beauty of the vestments, by the beauty of the iconostasis, by the beauty of the surroundings, and so on. And it has a large place, Pelikan says, in Byzantine doctrine. The very method of the Greek for theologizing was foreign to the Latins. And that's a very important thing. And basis of heresy, is, and here I'm coming to it, the basis of heresy was a different point of view about what theology was, what liturgy was, what human beings were, and what language was. Most of the theological schisms in the Eastern Orthodox Church and between the East and the West are basically emotional or political or economically based. I used the word based twice, didn't I, in that sentence. They are there because we look at things, one emotionally, one rationally. We look at things, this is the way we said it in Greek or in Hebrew or in Slavonic, and this is the way they said it in Latin. Or we look at it and say, we got to get those holy places back because they were God's holy places, but we're Latins and we really want to get it away from the Greeks. Or we Venetians want to get over there and get that route through the Mediterranean Sea so we can be economically there. Dr. Schramm talked about Rhodes today, the Venetian castle in Rhodes and in some of the other islands. Why were the Venetians there? Supposedly to keep the Turks out or the Arabs out. But basically they were there to keep the economics coming to the West instead of to Constantinople. And so you then make other people heresy. I've been a heretic to Christian News since 1948. About every 6 months my name gets mentioned. Most of the time it gets mentioned emotionally. And then after the emotion and after the politics and after they try to prove that the ALC and the LCA are really a bunch of heretics, then they get around to the reasons why. Then they get around to ration and rationality. It's a peculiar sort of thing. Now, Pelikan quotes a 12th century theologian in the Eastern Church, and I like this. Many of you may have heard of Origen, O-R-I-G-E-N. Origen was a very famous church father. He was pronounced a heretic by many of the councils. He translated a great many things, and he wrote a great many things. But one of these 12th century theologians, and here's your attitude toward theology, toward heresy coming out. The famous Origen, who was the pioneer of all our theology and laid its foundation, on the other hand, is the origin of all our heresies. You know, here's the person saying he's a saint. And all the heretics, by the way, in the Eastern Orthodox Church are still in that heavenly iconography. They're there. Maybe you ought to say one other thing about icons. Some of you, as tourists to Greece or the Holy Land, buy a picture that looks like an icon. To make an icon is a mystery. In our language, it would be called a liturgical or sacramental rite or act. Once it's bought by something other than a church, for use other than devotions in a home, by people who are of that faith, it is no longer an icon. So if you've bought an icon and you've got it home just on the wall, or you pull it out of your travel buffet where you got all your junk that you picked up on all your tours, and you say, here's an icon, you're lying. You have an Orthodox picture that was painted in the East. An icon is an icon is an icon only when it's used in its worshipful place. And I have some pictures of icon studios. I've talked to icon painters. Many Westerners are now starting to paint icons. They're not painting icons. They're painting saints in the iconic style. There's a difference. Now that may sound a small matter to you, but see, if painting and using an icon is a religious act, not an aesthetic act only, there's a great difference. In fact, the priest where we took some photographs on Cyprus, for example, who had just finished a very fine icon, who one of our people wanted to buy, he was very reluctant to sell it, because it was one of the better ones that we saw in that studio. Very reluctant to sell, because he knew that this Lutheran who was buying it to take home to Pennsylvania was not going to use it in his Lutheran church. He'd have to be a pastor, and was not going to have candles in front of it when he hung it up on his wall. So that's another part of the issue that needs to be talked about.
Don't you think that's true of our cross, too? Crosses are sometimes an in thing to wear.
Mm-hmm.
I always resent that a little bit, because the whole feeling isn't there.
It's a close analogy. The cross, to many people, has become an ornament rather than a symbol of faith and an expression of faith. And many non-Christians wear it with no consideration. The difference, I would say, is that most companies who mass make them, who stamp them out, whether it's in ivory or shell or wood or even olive wood to make it more sacred, we think, they really aren't doing it as a religious sacrament. They're doing it to sell and to make money, and it's not. It's a work of art. And some crosses are beautiful works of art.
Well, I recently had a chain and medallion of the Virgin Mary given to me by a woman who had that faith.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted me to have that chain. And she said, now you don't believe in the saints. She said, have it melted down and make into a cross. And I thought she had a great perception there.
Mm-hmm.
Because that saint wouldn't have that meaning for me, but it did for her. But the cross would, and she understood that.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, don't ever throw it away. And I that was the neatest thing that's happened to me lately. I really, really appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. We've talked about frequently schisms, we've talked about Orthodox and non-Orthodox churches, and people in the West have often heard about the 11th century split between the East and the West. That split took place long before that. It was just finally recognized in the time of there. Whether you think of three or four schisms, whether you think it came after the Third Ecumenical Council or the Fifth Ecumenical Council, or after Pope Leo decided unilaterally to change the Apostles' Creed, it wasn't the theology in the Apostles' Creed that was bugging them, although now they talk about it a lot, both the Eastern and the West. It was that Leo usurped the right of the consensus of councils to decide what ought to be a change, if a change was needed. The diversity was okay. If I would give my last lecture, it would be on the first among equals, and that gets into this whole business of the popes and the patriarchs and the various bishops around the East. We won't deal with that at all. But I like what is said by one of the theologians. His name is Loskin. And if you're interested in some of the books, there's a bibliography up there on the Eastern Orthodox Church. There's a lot of good stuff out most recently there have been three or four things published at St. Vladimir's that are not too expensive to get. And one of those books from St. Vladimir's, written by a French Orthodox priest who's now dead, his name is Losky, and he speaks about that whole argument of sacraments and the whole argument of transubstantiation when it did get in the 17th, 18th, and 19th century into the East. He calls it, listen to it, it almost sounds like Luther was writing, The Western Captivity of the Orthodox Church. Beautiful title, isn't it? Like the Babylonian Captivity when Luther was talking about the Pope and what he did to the church and so on. This is a basis thing. Now, the closest thing I know about what the Eastern Orthodox would be to us is if you know some of the history of the establishment of the Anglican Church under Henry VIII, and then the 39 Articles as they were written. The 39 Articles weren't written like the Augsburg Confession. The Augsburg Confession was written to say, this is how Catholic we are, and these are the things we don't like. The 39 Articles were written so ambiguously that a Catholic could say, that's what we believe. And the Lutheran or the Protestant or even the heir of Wycliffe could say, that's what we believe. And so ambiguity was a sign of the times in Henry VIII's time until they began to get codifying the whole thing as a very difficult way of putting things. They have theology now in Episcopal churches, and that's why they're having the big argument over ordination of women. They're having the big argument over their new prayer book and has it changed the theology. Floresti says, those of you who aren't quite sure that you like the new green hymnal, Floresti says, when you change the liturgy, you change the faith. We say when you change the catechism, or when we write a new doctrine, or when we have a new confession, or when Missouri and the ALC have a creedal statement of what we believe, then we may have changed it or summarized it. But just think about that. Ed mentioned this morning about Amazing Grace. Now that's a good hymn. And some of the other hymns that dropped out are also good hymns. But the hymns that are sung tell more about the faith of the group of people singing them than the creed that they say in the middle of the service.
Amen.
You know, what you do in liturgy determines your faith, whether you admit it or not. You know, after I've catechized for 2 years some kids, or for 6 weeks or 8 weeks or something, some adults, I don't know why I did that difference, but that was the way I was trained, that adults could learn it up here faster. And so we could give them a short course. But after you've done all that, your organist or your choir director or the lessons you read or the hymns you sing can make Methodists out of them all.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that's wrong. But they could make completely a non-Lutheran church out of it very quickly by the liturgy. Well,
isn't
that's
that
enough.
Nice?
It might be nice. It might be nice. Because then we get ecumenical.
Right.
Right. So you've got to weigh both things on there. But what I'm emphasizing is that by changing the liturgy, you've changed the experiential faith. Faith is defined by Lutherans most of the time, rationally. Although the third word that Luther uses is not really a rational word. He talks about understanding and commitment and trust. You know, listen to Losky again. I'll quote him. He uses a horrible word in the middle of it, but the first part you'll know. Faith is personal encounter and ontological participation. That means with your whole being. Yesterday's lecture. The totality of me is part of the body of Christ, participates in the mystery of the divine liturgy, participates in the heavenly celebration of the eighth day that we've been together. Personal encounter has been misused in California for humanistic psychology. It's been misused by some of the kinds of things that we call Pentecostalism at times, but personal encounter is part of faith. Faith is not a body of knowledge. It's not a rational dogmatic system. Faith is the meeting of Christ with his people. It's my recognizing I'm part of the family redeemed by God. I mentioned up here, and I want to move on a little bit, because the time keeps moving around pretty fast, that we need to talk about knowledge of God, not knowledge about God. Homo orda adorans, the worshiping person, has experience of God. He has knowledge of God. The catechism graduate, the seminary graduate, frequently has knowledge about God. There's a very big difference. I like C.S. Lewis, and here's another sacramental reverberation or mystery in my mind. We believe that we were made in the image of God, right? The image of God can be translated icon. C.S. Lewis has a beautiful passage in which he says, human beings are the icons of God. Now that means that it was a sacrament when I was born, because it was a mystery and God was involved. And now he uses another phrase, or another word, not a phrase, he's got a sentence about it. But he says, as the icon in the Greek church points people to the saints and to the whole eighth-day theology, so I am a pointer to my Creator and my Redeemer. I like that word, pointer. A human being is an icon and a pointer. A human being is a homo adorans. You know, Christ came, and I think this would get us into all kinds of arguments with theologians and lawyers. Christ came not to give us knowledge about God, definitions of God, distinctions about kinds of gods, but he came into the world to give us the experience of the presence of God among us. Within us, if you want to use the other translation. Because for us, the incarnation took place at either the conception or Christmas. Ed used the Christmas and the second coming design with chairs this morning. For the Eastern Orthodox, the incarnation includes the whole life of Christ, his death and his resurrection and ascension. We tend to think of the incarnation as his coming. The Eastern Orthodox think of the incarnation as the entire sweep of his being here until he ascended. And that was something very important.
Omaha, would you say a word? Isn't the modern distinction in theology, or the modern teaching view in theology, that we make a false distinction between the secular and the sacred?
Yes.
And that there's a sense in which everything is sacramental? If this is interrupting you...
No, it isn't. It fits very well. In other words, we have, in recent years, begun to say the totality of the human being, the totality of the experience, holistic, cosmological theology, we sometimes talk about it, so that the care of the earth, as Joe Sittler called his sermon, is as sacramental as the care of my, quote, soul, unquote.
No.
And the Eastern never did divide this, you see. If you're in heaven when you're sitting in church, you know, it's not secular and sacred. I'm getting ready for lunch. after that four-hour service, I'm beginning to get hungry, and they don't give me quite as much bread when I leave as I'd like, maybe. Although if I were poor, they'd maybe give me more. So the distinction between visible and invisible, militant and triumphant, secular and sacred, is not used very much in theology, and never was in the East. Although, you know, we make heresies out of people like that. Talking about these heretics, just a little, then I'm going to, about these abstractions. I mentioned that some people who are heretics are in the iconography. One of them is Theodore of Mopsuestia. He was condemned after he died as a heretic. Posthumously, they decided he was a heretic in some of the early councils. But in the Eastern Orthodox Church, he's a saint. A heretic becomes a saint. There are not many heretics. You know, there have been people recently in the ecumenical movement asking the Pope not only to remove the excommunication of Luther, but to declare Luther a saint. Now, when that happens, that'll be a great moment. because the Eastern people have done that for years. They made a heretic into a saint. Feels no incompatibility with that. It was only his mind that was made of God. His heart was right. His spirit was right. He worshipped right. He went to the church service right. He enjoyed the mysteries right. He was not a heretic in that sense of the word, so therefore he's a saint. He belonged to the family of God. In 1959, the highest authority that you can say there is an authority, and there really isn't, if I could give the sixth lecture, we'd get to it. The highest authority in the Eastern Orthodox Church, the Patriarch of Constantinople, said that all the people who had been called non-Chalcedonian, that's a technical name, that's the ones who were kicked out at the Council of Chalcedon because they, quote, weren't quite Orthodox enough for the East and the West people who were gathered there. That included the Abyssinians, that included the Ethiopians, that included the Copts, that included the Armenians, that included a great many people. And in 1959, the Patriarch of the Greek Orthodox Church, the first among equals of all the patriarchs in the Orthodox section, said, they are as Orthodox as we are. Nothing really happened politically about that. But what he was saying is, they've got the liturgy. We don't want to make those fine distinctions anymore, that because they were monophysites saying that Christ only had one nature, that therefore they're heretics. You see, they didn't want to split hairs anymore. You recognize that splitting hairs made heretics. And I guess there's a pun in the word there. The emotion made it, the politics made it, the semantics made it, the economics made it, but also this rational distinction of splitting hairs made it. Somebody asked me about essence. I think John Schramm asked about essence and substance. Those are Greek terms that the Greeks ignore. They've been made Latin terms. The Latins like to talk about the substance and the essence, about transubstantiation, about the body and the blood and the bread and the wine. They like to use those terms. Nobody uses that in the East at all anymore. They did back in the first three or four centuries, but they don't anymore. It's a very simple thing. Let's illustrate this political thing now. There are some people who just split off from the Presbyterian Church because they got a new hymnal. You remember? Just a bunch of Orthodox Presbyterians down, mostly in the Southeast, but there's some in Texas. There may be some up here, I don't know, who split from the Presbyterian Church. They split basically because they saw a change in the liturgy. It was an emotional reaction. And the people who are leaving the Episcopal Church because they're going to ordain women, they're not leaving just because of the left side. They got a lot of gut reactions about, I don't want to take communion from a woman. They got a lot of gut reactions about, I don't want a woman to be over me in the priestly thing. They may even have some problems about the other. So listen to this. The old Russians are a splinter group that Pelikan and Pete Corn, a very fine Missouri state. You want to know a little bit more about all the various families of these Eastern Orthodox and Eastern non-Orthodox people. Author Carl Pete Corn has been writing, and then he died, and then Tietjen has been editing. It's called Profiles of Belief, and it's going to be in three or four volumes. And the first volume is out. It's on Roman and Eastern Orthodox in America. The old Russians are mentioned there because we do have some of those old Russians. Now, listen to this. This is from Pete Corn. That's why I brought him up. The old believers movement in Russia was a, quote, visceral reaction. That's not over here, is it?
No.
A visceral reaction is down here or else over here if we want to go back to the hemispheres. Uh-huh. Of elements that were objecting to the Greek and Western influences that seemed to be importing things that were confusing and demoralizing to the old believers. That's why they're called the old believers. You know, so the Orthodox Presbyterians, the split off from the Episcopal Church, and maybe I should bring it up here, I don't know, although one of my best friends belongs to the organization.
maybe if we really recognize what Lutheran Alerts is all about, we'd recognize it's an old believers movement. And that's not to put it down, that's to recognize what it is. When my friend Dave Seberg, who was offered a job up here at the Tacoma Seminary for Lutheran Alerts Seminary, and I talk, we can rationally argue and have fun because we love each other and know each other. But viscerally, he's angry at Dave Preuss, he's angry at Bob Marshall, he's angry at every seminary professor in the ALC he's ever met, and it's this. He then has lots of arguments about it. But Lutheran Alerts, let's just paraphrase Peepcorn, Lutheran Alerts is a visceral reaction of conservative elements to new influences in the ALC and its seminaries. Could I paraphrase it that way? And if those of you who know Lutheran Alerts better than I do, I only know it through one or two of its members, recognize you don't have dialogue with Lutheran Alerts unless you happen to be very friendly, as I am with Dave. You have confrontation. You have anger. You have name-calling. You have all kinds of stuff going on, which is over here. It's emotional. It's visceral. Okay, another illustration that I think might be there, and then I'm going to let you answer the question. Meditation, asceticism, monasticism. Schramm talked a little bit about that. We tend to think of it, and Merton has helped change our minds about that, we tend to think of it as escape from the world. The Eastern Orthodox meditation is always for the world. Meditation and contemplation is not for me. There is no such thing as individual piety for most Orthodox Christians. It is the family. So what we call intercessory prayer is the major issue. Prayer for the world, prayer for the church, prayer for the people who are worshiping in the liturgy and other places. Even Mount Athos that many of you hear about, when they talk about it, it's this. They are quieting the body and the mind. They are positioning the body so that they can achieve something on behalf of the church by having transfigured themselves into the eighth day experience. Why? So that there they can make intercession for all the saints. Not for personal bliss. Not for personal salvation. Not for the kind of thing Luther did when he climbed the stairs in Rome. It was that. Well, my time's up. Let me just finish one little quotation, which is from an Orthodox theologian of the 20th century. And it's an ambiguous statement, because some of my Roman Catholic friends and some of my very Orthodox Lutheran friends say, aha, we better not let them get into the World Council of Churches. They're already in. And they outnumber all the rest of us, of course, by numbers of persons who are in members. But listen to this. There is only one church, and there are many different ways of being related to this one church, and many different ways of being separated from it. Now that's an Orthodox theologian statement. Some of my Catholic friends say, well, the only way to be related to it, these people, they're reading between the lines, say, you got to be Orthodox. But he doesn't say that in so many words, does he? He doesn't say that. He says there are many ways of being separated from it. And the Lutherans say, they're saying about us and other Protestants, we're separated from it. He didn't say that. That's what we read into it with our logic getting going on. He's merely saying, maybe he's talking about Jews. Maybe he's talking about Muslims. He's deliberately ambiguous again, because he never calls Lutherans heretics. He never calls Roman Catholics heretics. He never calls the non-Orthodox Easterners heretics. They're members of the family of God who have a different ways of relating to the family of God. Well, we got a minute or two for somebody who might want to ask some questions. We could go on for another hour or two on this subject. Yeah, Norm?
I just want to ask you about something. In our Lutheran church in Pennsylvania, when I was a boy, a service for some that I've heard no one speak about here, the service of confirmation at Easter time only. Mm-hmm. And that was a big Sigonite church.
Yeah.
Has anyone else had that experience? Because almost every family in the church had someone or was friends with someone who they confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
Like the class I was confirmed, there were 153 people, I think.
What part of Pennsylvania was that? Was it was
Pottstown.
Okay, now, but I was trying to think of, in parts of Pennsylvania, the Orthodox Church is very strong, and their confirmation and their baptisms are on Easter, or Easter Vigil, Easter night. There may be some influence there, I don't know.
All these young people, we all got nice new suit of clothes for that.
Most of the tradition I grew up with, Palm Sunday or Pentecost were the two traditional days for Lutherans, but Easter's as great a time as any. If you're here Thursday, we'll fight through one of the issues that some of my LCA theologians in seminaries as well as in headquarters think is a terrible issue. We're going to try to relate the theology of the cross and the theology of glory, and how can we learn from both and keep both in the proper sense of tension, just like hopefully we can keep Good Friday and Easter together rather than tearing them apart and saying this is more important than the other. Yeah, Dan?
Yeah, someone who studied Orthodoxy told me that they have a liturgy that you can say to renounce the heresies of Lutheranism. Wondering if you'd ever seen this.
There are a lot of liturgies like that, yes. But they were made in the times of turmoil.
And at the time of the Reformation.
The time of emotionalism.
Yeah.
And I mentioned somebody, I guess since he brings that up, we talk about justification by grace or justification by faith. Melanchthon I put over here, but he was sensitive enough to the fact that justification was a word that the Greeks didn't understand, that the Orthodox didn't understand. So when he translated the Augsburg Confession, and that's a pretty important one, translated it primarily for political reasons to get them on his side because they didn't like the Pope either, but he translated every time justification came, he used sanctification. Sanctification by grace, sanctification by faith. Because he was hoping to understand. Unfortunately, they didn't respond because they recognized it as a political gambit rather than an ecumenical gambit. Dan, one more?
Maybe this question has been asked because I missed it. Is our ordination of women a real block to our ecumenical relations?
Yes, ordination is, we had the Bishop of Limassol at our conference, the Greek Orthodox one, and the Episcopalians brought it up because the Anglicans and the Orthodox are still in dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bishop of Limassol said, if the Anglicans, he already knew the Episcopal here are doing it, he said if they do that, that's the end of the talks. We have nowhere to go.
So the Lutheran Orthodox dialogue is pretty well broken.
It's pretty well broken on that issue, although on other issues it's still possible.
Mm-hmm.
But they feel very strongly about that. The same thing about bishops and marriage is there too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know whether you knew this or not. Priests have to be married. Monks are the only ones who can become bishops in the Orthodox Church. You must be a single man who's never married, or else you were married, widowed, and then became a monk. Then you could become a bishop. So there are a few widowed bishops in the Orthodox churches. But there's no such thing. And yet, you know, we read Paul in Titus as well as other places that a bishop should be the husband of one wife. They handle that translation very easily. But that doesn't refer to this particular patriarch.
Is the ordination of women a pretty visceral or a gut thing?
Oh,
or
it's gut. You can
rather
see,
than, they don't have a real theology.
We spent an hour with this bishop catechizing him, trying to get some other stuff out of him. And the Episcopalian bishop was there,
mm-hmm.
and doing the catechizing mainly because he was worried about this. And that was the place where he got visceral. On all the other things, communion, mm-hmm. Even when we use the cliche, the stereotype that we have, somebody asked me up here at the coffee break, how come they don't do mission work? How come they don't do social action? He was very comfortable with that, you know, didn't have to defend himself or feel visceral about it. Because they do their mission work, and they have done their mission work, and they do their social action in their own way. It just doesn't happen to be our way. But ordination of women, got him.
What?
It's a gut reaction. You don't answer a why to a gut reaction.
Well, it's got to come from someplace.
Archetypal prejudice.
Possibly archetypal, if you want to go Jungian on me. It's possibly that. It's also their emphasis on tradition as being part of our liturgy and part of our life, rather than traditions, plural. I think it comes there. But the why question, you know, that's a legal question sometimes, but
I quote, on the left side of my head.
Right. I quoted here years ago, and some people didn't like me when I quoted it, so this is a good way to quit by quoting something people, and I know many people won't like. But when a friend of mine in some organizations we were using for husbands and wives and other things asked the question, why do you get upset? Well, why do you do that? He said, because my mother's left breast gave chocolate milk. And that's as good an answer to why as you'll find about human behavior, unless you're an out-and-out Skinner behaviorist. Thank you very much. Thursday we'll talk about the theology of the cross and theology of glory. Thank you.